I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Much has been written about the women Air Force service pilots, or WASPs, of World War II, but in the decade leading up to the war, women were already taking flight. Amelia Earhart was but one of the female pilots from that era. But the names and stories of other women, some of whom considered more skilled aviators than Earhart, have faded from history. Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History, brings to life female pioneers in aviation history, women who not only broke through gender barriers, but had skills, bravery, and tenacity that rivaled and even surpassed their male counterparts. Keith O'Brien is the author of Fly Girls. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Mindy.
Sure. Now, most Americans who know the famous female pilot, Amelia Earhart, we've heard about her. So when and how did you discover that there were other talented and successful women who were pioneering flight in America?
So I was, ironically enough, on an airplane, of all places, when I stumbled onto the little nugget that led me down the road to this story. I was reading a different book, and there was one line in this historical paragraph about an all-women's airplane race in 1929 featuring Amelia Earhart. And the line just stopped me because I had never heard of such a thing, you know, airplane races featuring Amelia Earhart. And you know, I did at that point what journalists do. You know, I just pulled the string, and as it unraveled, you know, I found myself sitting in old microfilm. You know, and when you're in old microfilm, when you go immerse yourself in the stories of 1929 and that time, you see this whole world of air races. 125,000 people would come out to these events and pay to see the races. And an equal number would watch for free from the hoods of their automobiles parked on nearby highways. 500,000 paying fans in a single weekend. Cities would vie against one another for the right to fly, to host these races. And initially, anyway, women were not allowed to race. But of course they wanted in. I mean, this was one of the biggest sports of this time. And it was more than just Earhart. Indeed, when you go back and spend time in this era, there were a number of women who were just as skilled, just as brave as she was.
So the book focuses on the decade from 1927 to 1937. So put American aviation into context at that time. What kinds of planes were being flown, and how did flight factor into the economic and cultural fabric of the country?
So, you know, when this narrative begins, my narrative begins around 1927, most planes are rather small, rather rudimentary. A lot of them are built out of wood, spruce, and linen stretched tight over the wood and then lacquered to make it firm. Many of these planes, of course, are single engine, but even those that are tri-motored, which was a very popular model at that time, are not anything like we would have today. Seaplanes are very popular, and so are blimps. There was a real debate at that time about whether one day we would all travel by blimp or by plane. I mean, that's how popular blimps were, and really how doubtful flight seemed in 1927. You know, of course, it is this time when Lindbergh flies across the ocean. You know, he makes his solo flight from New York to Paris and nonstop. And there was real question about whether this was ever be possible. In the same way we doubted in the 1960s whether we would ever make it to the moon. That's how unlikely it seemed to make this kind of airplane flight in 1927.
So you can see why it would be so exciting to see these air shows. It's, you know, at that time. So let's talk about the air shows. You mentioned how popular they are. What kind of course and challenges were put to these pilots?
There were two kinds of air races. There were the transcontinental air derbies, as they were called, where you would take off from, say, Los Angeles and fly to the site of the air races in Cleveland, or go from New York to Los Angeles. And then there were the pylon races, or as they were known, the free-for-alls. Pylon races were just that. It was a race around pylons, small towers, essentially, placed on the ground at a city in a triangular course. And, you know, these pylons were about 50 feet tall. And the goal was to race around it, just like NASCAR in the sky with multiple planes going around with you. And, you know, so you're flying at a high rate of speed, 200 miles an hour, maybe 250 miles an hour, 75 to 50 feet off the ground. You didn't want to fly much higher because if you cut the corner, if a judge standing at these pylons determined that you did not go around the tower, then you'd be disqualified. Mm-hmm. So you wanted to fly low to make it clear to the judge and also to yourself that you had actually rounded that pylon. So very dangerous.
I was going to say, we're talking some pretty big speed here, too. So very dangerous. And as we said, planes were not like what they are today. So was it regulated?
The air races?
Yeah.
I mean, marginally so, yes. You know, there were rules. There were standards. Some of those rules were quite sexist in barring the women from flying or barring them from competing in certain races, barring them from having a certain kind of engine. Men could fly, you know, in powerful planes. Women at times were forced to fly in planes that were less powerful. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, in any real way regulated? No.
Yeah.
You know,
and we should, from 1927, this is only 7 years after women had the right to vote.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, we tend to simplify that, too, and assume, well, women won the right to vote in 1920, and so equality was won.
Not so much.
In the late 1920s, when my narrative begins, actual laws on our books and ordinances in cities and towns banned women from doing all sorts of things, from serving on juries, from filing lawsuits, from driving taxi cabs, from holding as many as 15 different professions in this time. And married women actually had it even harder. Many communities, many school boards demanded that their female teachers be single. And so if you were a single female teacher and you got married, you were forced by local ordinance to leave your job because it was believed by school boards, including in many progressive cities. It was believed by school boards that a woman could not handle the stress of having the task of teaching children and of keeping house and raising children.
Yeah. So how are the winners of these races compensated?
You could win $10,000.
Which is a lot of money in that time. Yeah,
that's, you know, almost $100,000 in today's money. So mm-hmm. a great deal of money could be won by winning a single air race.
And by winning, also the money, were there opportunities that a win would lead these pilots to? I mean, other opportunities?
Well, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, so in this time, the three most popular sports in America were baseball, boxing, and air racing. So the stories of the air races filled the newspapers. It really, the aviators of this time were treated like gladiators, you know, real conquerors. And so to win the air races, to win at the air races would make you famous. Mm-hmm. You know, would make you a star, and would bring all kinds of other compensations, sponsorship deals, better planes, things like that.
Was commercial aviation taking off at this point?
Right about this time, yes. Yeah. The first real modern, quote-unquote, airlines began around 1929, just as women were earning the right to race.
So the women you profile in the book fly in these air races. How challenging was it for them to get permission to participate? You mentioned that some races banned women. So how did they get to participate?
So my story is, just to be clear, not an encyclopedic history of women flying in this time. It's a story, one specific story, of a handful of women who were friends and also rivals, mm-hmm. But really fighting together for this right. And they were fundamental in the beginning of earning this right. In 1928, the first, what was considered modern air races, were held in a bean and barley field south of downtown Los Angeles. Today, we know that bean and barley field by three letters. It's LAX. And these races were incredibly popular. They come, you know, 18 months after Charles Lindbergh has flown the ocean, and just a few months after Amelia Earhart has flown across the ocean by men as a passenger, but becomes the first woman. And so these races are incredibly popular. Women want in, and they begin lobbying the air race organizers for the right to fly in the 1929 air races, which were going to be held in Cleveland. And so it is because of their grassroots organizing, because of their lobbying, because of, you know, the noise that they made to be allowed to race, that they're ultimately given that right.
So how were these women viewed by their male counterparts?
They were dismissed. They were belittled. They were demeaned at every turn. You know, male pilots were aviators with a capital A. Mm-hmm. The press regularly dismissed the female pilots with terms like ladybirds, mm-hmm. sweethearts of the air. Girl flyers was the most common moniker that was given them in this day. Mm-hmm. And you know, they were criticized at times for just flying, right. You know. In these races, men crashed all the time. Mm-hmm. And when they did, they were just giving it their all. They were trying their best. They were doing it for aeronautics. And when men died in these races, as they did, they were often giving grand tributes on the field that very weekend, memorials. When the women crashed, when the women died, they didn't get tributes. Mm. They were often criticized, even in death, blamed.
They shouldn't be there, right? Yeah, right.
They were blamed for crashing their planes, even when it was clear to everyone who had seen the crash that it was the fault of the plane, that the wing had snapped off, that the engine had caught on fire. Right. Women would be blamed.
How difficult was it for women to get pilot license in the 1920s and 30s?
Well, they had the same right to get a pilot's license as anyone else. And, you know, so they could certainly do it, legally anyway. Culturally, it was a different story. Most flight instructors were men. And the female pilots in my book, you know, would all complain about the way they were treated by male flight instructors. As one of them would say, you know, they treat the task of teaching a woman how to fly in the way they treat household tasks, like repairing a hole in a sock. You know, they didn't want to do it.
Right.
So these women who earned their pilot's license and learned to fly and joined the air races had to be good at what they were doing, had to be indeed better than good. Mm-hmm. They had to be above average or more, because they had to fight through problems before they even got in the air. You know, the comments and criticisms and sideways looks that they would get on the ground.
Yeah, you know, they had to be tough. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so Fly Girls profiles five women: Ruth Nichols, Louise Thaden, is that Thaden?
Yes.
Ruth Elder and Florence Klingensmith and Amelia Earhart. So let's start with Ruth Elder. She was an actress who achieved fame when she attempted to be the first woman to fly a transatlantic, not as a pilot, but as a passenger. So what was her motivation?
Well, so actually Ruth Elder was a pilot on her plane in 1927 and was not yet an actress. She was, in 1927, working at a dentist's office in Florida, had been learning to fly for a couple of years. Charles Lindbergh flies the Atlantic in the spring of 1927, and that summer, as air fever sweeps America, Ruth Elder decides she wants to be the first woman to fly across the ocean. She will do it with the help of some wealthy male backers who will buy her a $35,000 plane, very expensive mm-hmm. plane for those times. And she will fly that plane with a male co-pilot across the ocean in October 1927. It's a dream, you know, for which Ruth Elder really will pay an awful price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she was not successful, right?
She was not successful.
She had to be rescued.
She did. she made the longest flight at that time that a woman had ever made. She and George Haldeman, her co-pilot, flew 2,400 miles off Long Island, straight out to sea, trying to reach the coast of France. Mm-hmm. And they realized after 32 hours in the air, 32 hours, that they still weren't anywhere close to shore and were running low on fuel and were having engine trouble. They knew they weren't going to make it. Mm-hmm. By a miracle, they saw a Dutch freighter on the water down below. They dropped down and dropped a note onto the deck to ask, "Where are we?" Mm-hmm. And the Dutch sailors painted on the deck that they were 300 miles from the Azores. They hadn't even made it to the Azores, a flight you can make today from Logan in just a few hours.
Yeah.
And so they made the decision at that point to ditch, and they crash-landed, essentially, into the water next to the freighter, escaped the cockpit as it filled with water, mm-hmm. and swam to safety on the ship.
But of course, she laid the groundwork for other female pilots, including Ruth Nichols. So tell us more about her and why she started flying.
Ruth Nichols was the daughter of Wall Street wealth. She was born on the Upper East Side of New York and raised in Tony, Westchester County. Until, you know, the Great Depression, her family had money. But, you know, Ruth wasn't really interested in money. She was interested in prestige, interested in adventure. She wanted to learn to fly. She made her first bold decision by not getting married after high school like her parents wanted her to. Instead, she enrolled at Wellesley College here just outside of Boston and would graduate from Wellesley in 1924. It is here at Wellesley that she decides she wants to fly planes, and indeed she wants to set records. And by early 1930s, Ruth Nichols, not Amelia Earhart, Ruth Nichols is just objectively speaking the most accomplished, most famous female pilot in this country. She has the speed record. She has the transcontinental speed record. She has the altitude record. And in June of 1931, Ruth Nichols will set off trying to be the first woman to fly solo across the ocean. It is 1 year before Amelia Earhart will attempt to make this same flight. And were it not for happenstance and bad luck, everything we know about Amelia Earhart and women's aviation history in this time would be completely different.
Yeah. There's a passage from the book that describes the start of Ruth Nichols' attempt to fly from St. John's, Newfoundland to Europe. Can you share that passage with us?
Okay. Sure. So this is June 1931. She's going to be leaving here from Brooklyn, New York, and she's headed up the coast following the Great Circle Route, just as we do today. When you fly to Europe, you don't fly straight out to sea. You follow the curvature of the Earth. So she's going to be flying up the coast, plans to refuel in New Brunswick, Canada. The flight up the coast was uneventful, as easy as Nichols thought it would be. And by sundown, she spied the tiny airfield in New Brunswick where she planned to stop for the night. It didn't look good. Instead of an expansive field, wide and open, it was more like a small bowl, a veritable trap, she thought, dropped into a valley in the middle of the hilly Canadian woods. Believing she must be mistaken, that this couldn't be New Brunswick, she circled the airfield twice, checking her maps. But no, this was it. Despite years, months, and weeks to plan, she and her team of consultants had failed to properly investigate the very first stop on the journey, this trap of a runway in the woods. Now it was too late. With the sun in her eyes, photographers waiting on the ground, and darkness coming soon, Nichols decided to land. She came in fast at 80 miles an hour, half blinded by the sun. Unable to get a clear view of the runway below, Nichols missed her mark, touching down not at the start of the runway, but in the middle. Realizing now that she wouldn't have enough time to stop the plane before it barreled into the craggy rocks at the runway's edge, Nichols hit the throttle, trying to take off again. And for a moment, it looked like she would succeed. With the Akita's engine shrieking and its tires squealing, Nichols lifted the plane off the runway just before the landing strip came to an end. She was in the air again, but only a few feet up, and still so low that the plane's propeller skimmed the ground, mowing a path through the brush. There was not enough time. There was not enough space. The Akita was heading for a rocky ledge, and Nichols braced herself for the inevitable, a crash. The rocks ripped away the wooden undercarriage of the plane, shattering it like a matchbox. The engine broke apart, and the cockpit splintered, and the Akita stopped dead in the waist-high bushes, jerking Nichols' body forward with such force that she felt as if the plane's tail were on top of her. People on the ground waited for an explosion. Nichols did too. Get out, she told herself. Get out. Wincing in pain, she climbed through the jagged wreckage and fell to the ground, free, apparently safe, and suddenly aware that she was not alone. A photographer was already upon her, snapping pictures. Then a half dozen other men with pickaxes and fire extinguishers arrived. But they found no one to save, no fire to put out, no explosion coming. Just an injured pilot standing there with a request for her would-be rescuers. Wire, she said, for another plane.
Was Ruth Nichols' bravery and tenacity shared by the other women that you talk about in the book?
Absolutely. You know, a word that gets bandied around a lot when you talk or write about aviation in this time is fearless. That's not the right word. They were all afraid because they all knew exactly what could happen. All of these women crashed, all of them, including Amelia Earhart. Many of them were injured in those crashes. All of them had seen other crashes. Many of them had seen their friends crash and die. Mm-hmm. So they knew exactly what could go wrong and how quickly it could go wrong. And still they went. So they were not fearless, but in a way they were unafraid.
Yeah. Well, and tragedy strikes in 1933 when Florence Clingan Smith crashes and is killed in the race outside of Chicago. And instead of making a note that she flew her crippled plane away from people and ensured that no one else would get injured, the inquest suggests the crash can be blamed on the fact that the pilot was a woman. So tell us how the public and investigating authorities responded to that crash and death.
So Florence Clingan Smith is one of the core characters of Fly Girls. And she was one of the most talented aviators, male or female, in this country at that time. She was especially proficient at the pylon races, you know, whipping her plane around those towers. And so in 1933, Florence Clingan Smith gets an invite to do the most radical thing of all. She's going to race the men in Chicago in September of that year, just about this time of year. And as you said, you know, she's in this race. She's vying right there for the lead. She's in third place. And her wing disintegrates in mid-flight, buckling under the strain of the speed. She peels off the course. She flies away, crashes, and dies. You know, when this happened to men, you know, they were treated as heroes. As you said, you know, they hold the very next day in Chicago an inquest to determine what had happened. Even though everybody saw what had happened, the wing broke apart. They hold this inquest, and right away in the inquest, they're questioning her skills. They're questioning her ability to fly this plane, this particular fast plane. And they're also questioning her, quote, stamina. One witness testifies that she must have fainted in the cockpit. That's why the plane went down. But the real fixation is on her condition at that time, as they called it, her condition. The coroner points out to the race organizers that Florence Clingan Smith was menstruating at that time. She was on her period. And this is their focus. This is what they're going to blame her crash on. And while this was so infuriating for me personally to find this, knowing how talented and brave Florence Clingan Smith was. And while it might be shocking to your listeners, in the 1930s, the U.S. Department of Commerce, which was the regulating agency at the time, advised in its written rules that women should not fly within 3 days of their menstrual period. And so they make this the focus of their investigation. And in the next day's papers, They say that Florence crashed because she was ill and weakened by her condition, and that she flew disregarding this condition to the danger of herself and others. It is a despicable thing. And, you know, I can tell you exactly where I was when I first started reading these stories about Florence, because it just blew me away. And it really is... The the glue around which this narrative sticks, because you know, they not only blame Florence for her own death, they use it then, the male race organizers use her death as an excuse to do what they had wanted to do for a while, which is banish the women. No more flying in the air races. And, you know, this does not sit well with her friends and the other female pilots of the day, Amelia Earhart and Ruth Nichols and Ruth Elder and Louise Thaden. This is not going to sit well with them. And they will fight a bitter war with the men to get back into the races.
So how did Florence's death affect these women?
Well, I mean, of course they were saddened. And, you know, she was so young, 29 years old. And they were all, in particular, very upset about the way the whole affair was handled. Not just the inquest and the blaming, but how her body was even handled. You know, I mentioned before that male pilots would often get grand tributes on the field when they died. At times, their bodies would be cremated and their ashes scattered from the sky, you know, while the crowd held a moment of silence. You know, when Florence died, they shipped her body back to her hometown of Fargo, North Dakota, naked and wrapped in newspapers in a pine box. Mm. The mortician who received it there gave an oral history about 35 years ago before he died about this. And he said, you know, in 50 years of receiving and shipping bodies, you know, hundreds of bodies, he never saw another case like it.
Yeah. Louise Thaden was another female pilot we're talking about who participated in the air races, but she also had a family. How did being a mother factor into her choices and opportunities to pursue flying?
Well, she was the rarest kind of aviator in these days, you know, a woman who flew, a woman who raced, and a mother. She has her first child in 1930, her second in 1933, at a time when our culture, and indeed many husbands, expected wives to stay home and raise the children. You know, Louise did a very modern thing, something that both fathers and mothers today do. You know, she tried to have it all, you know, juggling her personal ambitions and her career goals, which she had, with her love for her children and her responsibilities at home, which she had. And, you know, having children, you know, did change her approach. She became, as people might expect, she became more cautious, more methodical. She wanted to fly meticulous races because, you know, she knew, of course, that other people now were relying on her, not just herself. And, you know, it's really because of you know, her children that Louise makes a couple of decisions. First, she will not fly across the ocean. You know, while Ruth Nichols and Amelia Earhart are jockeying to get across first solo in a plane, Louise has no intention of flying across the ocean. As she says, too much can go wrong too quickly, and when you're out there, there's no hope. And, you know, when her good friend, really her best friend, Amelia Earhart, starts making these bold flights in succession, flying solo across the Atlantic, then flying solo across the Pacific in January 1935, Louise sends her this telegram, which is just really telling. Louise was from Arkansas. She spoke with a plain-spoken twang. And she said to Amelia, after she made her flight across the Pacific, Louise told her, "Darn your hide, I could spank your pants. One day you have to tell me why you do things like this." And she goes on to tell Amelia that she needs to rest on her laurels. And she specifically ends this telegram saying, you know, "You're worth more alive than dead." And it's really prescient, because it would be 2 years later that Amelia would make her round the world flight.
The 99s is an organization of female pilots that was formed during this time, and it's still in existence today. So what's the purpose of the organization?
The 99s was an organization by women pilots for women pilots. It was formed in December 1929, just a couple of months after their first foray in the air races. The women knew that even as they tried to beat one another in the races, or, you know, beat one another across the ocean, that they had to stick together. They had to stay together on the ground. And so they sent out invites to all the licensed female pilots in this country. There would have been at this time about 30 million adult women in America. There were 117 licensed pilots, 117. So they sent invites to 117. They received replies, affirmative replies, from 99 women. And so it was Amelia Earhart who suggested that they call themselves the 99s.
Oh. So Amelia Earhart, probably the most famous that we know of, had, I think people would be surprised to learn that before she started flying, she was working outside Boston as a social worker. So how did she end up in aviation?
Amelia Earhart learned to fly in 1921 while living in Los Angeles. It was just something she wanted to do. And for a brief time in Los Angeles, she had a plane, her own plane, and made headlines in the local aviation press. But her parents divorce, and her mother is going to move and live with Amelia's sister in Medford, Massachusetts. So Amelia goes with her, comes here around the mid-1920s. It was not the life that Amelia had imagined for herself. She is now almost 30 years old and living with her mother and sister on Brook Street in Medford. She tries to get into college but doesn't have money to do it. She tries to get various jobs in aviation but can't, and finally takes a job as a social worker on Tyler Street in Boston, where she's serving immigrants. Helping to teach new immigrants to this country how to speak English or how to get jobs. And, you know, it is here in this settlement house for immigrants on Tyler Street that wealthy men, including George Putnam of Putnam Publishing in New York, pluck Amelia from obscurity in June of 1928. There is a plane, a very expensive tri-motored seaplane that is sitting in the water at Boston Harbor that has two men ready to fly across the ocean. They need a woman to ride in it so it can make headlines for being the first plane to carry a woman across the Atlantic. They want a pilot, but so that really brings them to Amelia. But they give her no responsibilities to fly. Her only job in June of 1928 was to sit in the back and take notes for a book that she would write for George Putnam.
Talk about her skills as a pilot in comparison with some of her female counterparts.
So Amelia was not an experienced flyer in the pylon races or in the free-for-alls that, say, Florence Klingensmith would later go on to race in. And she knew that. She acknowledged that. It wasn't really her best skill. And, you know, Amelia was really more prone to making long-distance flights. And, you know, and that's not to take anything away from her, because long distance flights were just as dangerous at times as these pylon races, you know, especially if you were going at a high rate of speed, you know, to tax your engine over the course of hundreds of miles, a few thousand miles, could lead to problems as well. That's where she would put her focus in what she had left of her life. And it was a very short time in the spotlight for her. You know, she's discovered essentially in 1928 and disappears in 1937. And it is really in this time that she makes daring flights. And she makes them really as an answer to her critics. You know, after that flight in 1928, flown by men across the ocean, she became famous. But, you know, there were men, aviators especially, who looked down on her because they believed that she was a gimmick, that she had been chosen by George Putnam and saved from, as one would say, saved from being an old maid. You know, and so she knew that, And so she would make daring flights as an answer to these critics to prove
that she could do it.
That she could do it. Yeah.
So why do you think Amelia Earhart achieved such fame while some of these other female pilots faded from history?
There's a few reasons. You know, she by 1931, you know, isn't the most accomplished. But by 1937, just objectively speaking, she is. You know, she's flown solo across the Atlantic. She's flown solo across the Pacific. She has, you know, been on the lecture circuit in this country for years, making hundreds of lectures a year. She's really the second most famous woman in America after Eleanor Roosevelt. But she's done it in part with a massive publicity machine at her back. You know, I mentioned George Putnam, who will discover her and pluck her from obscurity in Boston. Amelia marries George Putnam in February 1931 in Connecticut. And, you know, it is because of this, you know, relationship that she, you know, is able to stay in the news in ways that Louise Thadon cannot, in ways that Ruth Nichols cannot. And so the combination of her fame, of the publicity machine at her back, and then, of course, her disappearance and the mystery around it would really, you know, suck all the oxygen out of the room, you know, and George Putnam would live for many more years. And even after Amelia was gone, you know, he was still, you know, living off of her name in some way.
Keeping her alive. Yeah. So other women's stories are not lost just to history, but even to their families. So were descendants of these women aware of their accomplishments, or was this a surprise to them?
Yes and no. Louise Thadon, as I mentioned, had two children, and her son and her daughter both also had children. And her daughter is still alive today. She'll turn 85 this month and lives in Maryland. Her grandchildren are still alive. And of course, they are well aware of Louise's story because there's a direct heritage there. With the other women, you know, they didn't have children. And, you know, so you're left with, as a researcher, I was left with tracking down nephews or great nephews, great nieces. And, you know, in some cases, you know, they all knew a little bit about their aunts, their great aunts. But they didn't know the whole story. Mm-hmm. And it's been fascinating being on the road recently for this book. I have met now a couple of people who have come out and said, oh, I'm related, I believe, to so-and-so in your book. Can you tell me more about her? Mm. You know, it's, you know, just this long ago, you know, history, family history for them, you know, shrouded in the clouds.
Yeah. So was the research difficult to come by?
It was. You know, this story almost exclusively is built on primary and secondary sources, on archival material. Newspaper accounts and radio accounts were certainly very helpful, especially when reconstructing races. Mm-hmm. You know, if you raced in Chicago in 1933, there were like 5 daily newspapers covering it that day. So you've got lots of different angles on it. But to really know them, to really get inside them, to know their internal thoughts, fears, dreams, challenges, I needed their archives, you know, diaries, letters, flight logs. And that was challenging. Amelia Earhart's archives are voluminous and well-known. They're at Harvard and Cambridge and Purdue University in Indiana, mostly. But the others were harder to find. Mm. And, you know, I had some lucky breaks here.
And did in Amelia's writings, did you find her writing about the other women? Did you find correspondence?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So that was helpful.
It was, you know, but what was also helpful is finding letters that really had never been utilized before, that were in some of these other women's more obscure archives, where they were writing to Amelia or Amelia had written to them.
So what was the most surprising thing you discovered in your research?
Well, I think the danger certainly was surprising. I was also surprised by Amelia's story. You know, I think we've simplified her story, and You know, I didn't know that the first time she went across the ocean, she was flown by men. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that these other women would try to get there before her. But, you know, I think the maybe not the most surprising thing, but the greatest thing that I was able to find here was some of these women's papers. You know, we've talked a little bit about Ruth Nichols, who really was Amelia's greatest challenger mm-hmm. in this time. And, you know, were it not for bad luck, might have been Amelia Earhart, right. essentially. You know, she lived a long time. She was from money in New York. And she knew her whole life she was important. She knew it. And so I just knew that she had left her papers somewhere. I knew it. Just as a reporter, mm-hmm. I knew Ruth would have done that. And I couldn't find them anywhere. And, you know, to make a long story short, I finally got lucky, and I found online a PDF that was a finding aid for a Ruth Nichols archive in a small regional airport in Ohio.
Oh my goodness!
I'd already been to this airport because they have a small museum there, and I had asked for everything they had on all of these characters. And they brought me, you know, very little on Ruth Nichols. But here's this finding aid. So I sent it to them. I said, "Well, do you have this? It looks like you have something more." And they said, "Well, we need to check storage. We need to check the back room." And so I got a call later that day. So, "Well, I've gone to the back room, gone to storage, and it does look like we have a lot on Ruth Nichols." And I said, "Well, you know, maybe what you think is a lot isn't what I think is a lot. So could you take a picture?" And they took a picture and they emailed it to me. And here in this windowless cinder block room filled with clutter and boxes was a wall of file cabinets labeled
wow.
Ruth Nichols.
Wow.
And of course, I went back to Ohio and I went back to this little museum and they left me in this room. And, you know, the first thing I did was I pull open all these drawers and there it was, you know. Her whole life organized alphabetically, organized by year, organized by flight, her letters, her mm. diaries, her flight logs. It was all there.
Wow, and, what a find.
I mean, you know, and I just knew, like, in that moment, like, I was going to be able to bring Ruth mm. Nichols back on the pages of this book.
Yeah. Women were called up during World War II to serve as pilots in the Air Force. They were known as WASPs. How much did the fly girls of the 20s and 30s help pave the way for the women to fly for the Air Force?
They were critical. It was all connected. You know, this story, my story, unfolds between 1927 and 1937. And, you know, these women were given ample opportunities to quit. The men wanted them to quit. And if they had accepted, say, their banishment from the races in 1933, they never would have had the opportunities to join the military in the early 1940s. Because, you know, one of the younger women who comes on late and actually wins an air race in 1938, after my narrative is over, was named Jackie Cochran. And it is Jackie Cochran, more than anyone else, who pushed for the right of women to serve in the military and fly in the military in World War II. And she did so on the platform of the fame that she built in the air races in the late 1930s. Mm. If the women who had come just before her, you know, Amelia and Louise and Ruth Nichols and Ruth Elder and Florence, if they had stopped flying, Jackie Cochran's platform does not exist. Mm. And there would have been no WASPs. They were all connected.
Did any of the women you profile go on to serve as a WASP?
No. No. Louise had children. Ruth Nichols worked in human aid during the war. Essentially, she founded her own version of the Red Cross. And you know, others, you know, went in different paths.
There are a number of instances in the book when these women talk about their hopes for a future when men and women are on equal footing, when they earn positions and pay based on their skill and not gender. It's 2018. We're still not there.
Nope.
What do you think this piece of history says to us in 2018?
I mean, unfortunately, I think it says we still have a long way to go, you know, and I think, you know, if anything, you know, the events of the past 18 to 24 months in this country have, I hope, revealed to everyone what women themselves have long known, which is it is still hard to be a woman, especially trying to break in to a traditionally male-dominated field. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be, you know, a real shocking thing to Amelia Earhart and these women who believed they were on the cusp of something 85 years ago.
Yeah. So what do you think we can learn from these women's struggles and their victories?
I think the most salient lesson here is, you know, you cannot quit. You cannot stop, and you must stick together. You know, Amelia Earhart had a line that it was powerful in 1935, and it's just as relevant today. She said that, you know, if women ever expected to be accepted in a male-dominated society, they had to keep knocking on the door. And as she said, as more of us knock, more will enter. You know, it was true then. And, you know, sadly, it's still true in many ways today.
The book is Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. We'll have a link with more information about the book and upcoming book talks at our website, capeandislands.org. Keith O'Brien, thanks for coming in and thanks for uncovering this history for us.
Thank you for having me, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.